This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Sub 70 podcast. This is Jay. Just wanted to give a quick little intro here before we get into our interview with Mark Calcavecchia. First of all, thank you to Calc. He was an awesome guest, great with his time, and very easy to work with. We appreciate that. The interview itself was about an hour long. It's a really awesome interview, covered a wide variety of topics. Obviously, we talked about his golf life, from his youth and amateur playing days, his near misses at Augusta, his Open Championship victory and Ryder Cup victory, and also just some other topics, including his friendship with Tiger Woods, who he would want to play money games with, his interest in bowling, a whole bunch of different topics, and it's very entertaining, and it was a great conversation that Jason had with Calc. So thank you to Calc, and hopefully you guys enjoy it. It's definitely very interesting. So one quick disclaimer and apology. I am definitely not an audio engineer. I have zero experience editing or dealing with audio in general. So I do have to apologize for the first 7 to 8 minutes of the interview itself. We used Skype to conduct the interview, and I don't know if it was a phone or a Skype issue, but there is a clicking sort of noise in the background for that first 7 or 8 minutes. After that, the audio quality is perfect. Everything was good to go. So hopefully we'll diagnose that, figure out what happened, and avoid that in the future. But just bear with us on this interview. I apologize. So here's the interview. Hopefully you like it. Thanks.
Well, first off, I'm really excited to have Mark Calcavecchia for our first podcast for Sub 70 Golf. 28 worldwide victories, Open champion, Australian Open champion. It's truly an honor to have you on the podcast, and I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
First question, how is your health overall? I noticed through your Twitter feed you've had some back issues and whatnot, so how are you feeling for the 2018 season on the Champions Tour?
Actually, it's coming along fantastic. About 2.5 weeks ago, I had a what's called a rhizotomy on my back, which is basically where they go in and fry the nerves or cauterize the nerves, if you will. And there's 8 nerves. There's 2 nerves that come out of each facet joint. So they went in and they just burnt those. And as painful as that was for about an hour, it's really starting to feel really good. And I'm hopefully get 6 months to a year out of that, from what I understand. Jay Haas just did that a few years ago, and the same sort of thing with him. He got about 6 months out of it, did it again, and he's been feeling great ever since. So that's kind of my plan, and been doing some exercising this winter, so I'm feeling great so far, getting ready to start the season.
Are you back to being able to practice at the level you want to practice at this point, or is it still a little bit of time for that healing process before you can
I'm back at it 100%. Yesterday was probably my biggest, longest day of practice this year. I was pretty much at the course for about six hours straight. I played 18 holes. I had 2 different range sessions, and then I went, came home and rested for a little bit, and then I went back out to the course again and played 9 more holes. So it was a big day of golf. So and felt great. Had no back twinges at all. So it was very encouraging. So really looking forward to having a pain-free year for the most part. You just can't. It's been bothering me for 5 years, and I just needed to do something. I looked into surgery at the end of last year, and just. I've had so many people just tell me to avoid that if you can, and finally looked into another option. So hopefully I can hang in there and feel good for most of the year.
Is the Champions Tour as much fun as you thought it would be? Were you itching to get out there in your late 40s to play against the guys you played against for all those years? The atmosphere, is it sort of everything you thought it would be?
It sure is. I was itching to get out there. And in my case, I was very lucky because I was fully exempt right up until the time that I joined the Champions Tour when I was 50 years old. And not many guys really have that luxury. So I was fortunate there. And I played great my first 2.5 years, 3 years on the Champions Tour. And it was a lot of fun. You know, I had a lot of good chances to win tournaments. Let a few of them slip. But, you know, that's going to happen. And then really starting in 2013 is when my back started to bother me. And I won't say the last 4 or 5 years have been that much fun, but you know, I still do get excited to go to tournaments. Even when I go to these tournaments, knowing I'm not feeling great, but you know, I've been playing golf all my life and I know that any given week, you know, you start out of nowhere, your putter gets hot. You hit a few good shots and boom, you know, you rattle off 3 or 4 or 5 birdies in a row. And, the next thing you know, you feel like you're going to catch fire and have a chance to win. So, you know, that's why we play every week. I'm going to keep plugging away for hopefully another 5, 6, 7 years.
Is the pressure the same? Let's say you're coming down the stretch in a Champions Tour event. Is the feelings pretty much exactly the same as a PGA Tour event during that, say, final 9 holes on a Sunday where you're going up against guys, and hopefully our listeners know this, but those guys in the Champions Tour you're competing against, you guys can really still play. And it's very hard to win out there. Is the pressure still the same coming down the stretch, or is it a little less pressure than the PGA Tour events that you won or played in?
You know, it's probably a little bit less. You know, for me, when I'm trying to win an event on the Champions Tour, I'm still nervous, obviously, and I think everybody else is too. But I'd say there's definitely a little less pressure. It's not as big a deal, obviously. It's just the money's probably a fifth of what the guys play for on the Champions Tour. So, I mean, on the PGA Tour. So financially, it's not near as big a deal. You know, people do watch us and it's still important. And, you know, we're out there, we all have a lot of self pride still. We do take a lot of pride in what we're doing and we do, we all show up with hopes of winning. And when you get in a chance to, when you do get the chance to win, you know, you're nervous coming down the last 9 holes and because you want to win. You know, when you're upper 50s, you know, that you realize the chances probably going to be few and far between. So you want to get the job done when you can.
And this sort of goes into my next question as well, is as you are getting into your later 50s and you've played well in the Champions Tour, you have 3 victories, but what would a senior major or Champions Tour major, assuming you're healthy in 18, mean for you and your Champions Tour career at this point?
You know, I've kind of been thinking about that in the off season. I'm really kind of looking for that this year. If I do or am lucky enough to win a tournament this year, I'd really like it to be a senior major. And I do love St. Andrews. I think the courses that we play this year, although I haven't played one of them, the tournament we play up in Chicago. But the other courses that we played the senior majors at, I played, and you know, I think they all set up pretty good for me. So I think, you know, I've only won 3, but you know, if I only win one more, it would be great for it to be a senior major for sure.
Well, I can totally understand where you're coming, you know, at from having a major on the PGA Tour to get one in the Champions Tour. It'd sort of be a nice cap to your career on the Champions Tour, and I can't answer the question for you about the course you're going to be playing in Chicago. Exmoor Country Club is a fantastic track. I've been lucky enough to play it, so it's going to be a great event for you guys out there. And whoever wins that, definitely going to be a worthy champion from that course.
I've looked at it on Google Earth, and it looks. I enjoy looking at golf courses, on the maps, and it looks beautiful. So I'm looking forward to getting to it.
Well, my next question I have for you is, growing up in Laurel, Nebraska, my question, and I've actually been there on a golf trip.
Have you really?
Heading out to, we were heading out to the Prairie Club, and we drove through Laurel, stopped and paid tribute to the sign that they have for you at the 9-holer that you grew up playing. So it's kind of cool to see that. But how did you guys wind up in Nebraska, and then how did you start playing golf when you were out there?
Yeah, well, my mom and her sister, when they were both 16 years old, or maybe they were 17, decided to go out to Washington, D.C. and meet a couple of sailors and get a job out there. And they both were born in Windside, Nebraska, which is 15 miles from Laurel. And sure enough, they met a couple of sailors in the Navy, and they dragged them back to Nebraska, and they got married later on that year, and ended up, you know, obviously living there, and I was born there in 1973. Back then, the nearest golf course was in either Wayne, or I think there was one in Wakefield as well, which were 15 miles away. Back in the 60s, driving 15 miles to play golf was just, you know, almost crazy. So my dad and his two buddies bought what then was a cornfield right outside of town there. And they just turned it into a little nine-hole golf course. And when I learned how to play golf there, the only thing that was irrigated were the greens and the tees. And the greens were just little small round things. They planted some trees, but they were just sticks at the time. So literally, it was just a field with tees and greens, and that's where I learned how to play golf.
Was your dad a good player?
No, I mean, nobody back then was. You know, they were a bunch of farmers, and you know, they were they all liked to play golf. Although my dad did make a hole in one there, he made the first hole in one at Cedar View. He hit a 5-wood on number 5, and of course, it never left the ground. But, you know, rolled about 200 yards down the hill and went in. And they said you could hear him yelling. Yelling all across town, but he could break 50 for 9 holes, but that was about it. And my older brother, who was actually 11 years older than me, could play a little bit. He could keep it around 40 for 9 holes, and he liked to play with his friends. So of course, as a little boy, I started going out to the course with him when I was 5 or 6 years old. And you know, you just like to tag around with my dad, my older brother. So I went everywhere with them. So I went to the golf course with them and just started grabbing it like a baseball bat. And just of course, I got a little junior set of clubs and just started swinging at it and hitting it and just grew to love it.
But I'm assuming at that point, no competitive golf from a junior standpoint until you moved to Florida when you were 13.
I played in a few junior tournaments, probably not until I was 11 or 12. I remember, I think the first trophy I won at Norfolk Country Club, I think I shot 94. You know, and I was pretty happy about that. I'm guessing I was probably 11 or 12 at that point. But really didn't, you know, get into golf big time until I got down to Florida. But when I was 13, I was starting to improve pretty rapidly. But you know, I had to learn how to hit out of bunkers. We didn't have any sand traps at Cedar View Country Club, so there was a big learning curve when I got down to North Palm Beach Country Club. So I had a lot of learning to do quick.
And then when you got down to the to Florida, I should say, when you were 13, is that when the game really started to take off, and the talent was obviously, you know, you played Division I golf at Florida, so obviously your junior career in Florida must have been pretty strong. I'm assuming with the competition and whatnot you were playing against sort of really made your game better and improved a lot.
I could hit it pretty good, but like I said, I didn't know how to play out of bunkers and you know, around trees, so I had to learn how to curve the ball, and I did have a lot of God-given talent, but I just played all day long, and I improved rapidly. Obviously, my dad, we had a Palm Beach County Junior Golf Association, which they still have to this day. Played golf all summer long, pretty much every day, all day. And but you know, by the time I was 15, 16, I was winning pretty much everything in sight around Palm Beach County. Won the state high school championship in my junior year. In 77, won the Orange Bowl Invitational, which is a big junior golf tournament down in Miami in 77. So by then, I was winning a lot of junior tournaments around the state of Florida. So I was, by then, really one of the best juniors in the country.
Were you playing against some guys, competition level, that actually made the tour at some point later in their career as well? Was the competition pretty strong you were playing against in that region of Florida at that point in time?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Willie Wood and I were just talking a few months ago when we played in Virginia we played in a couple of tournaments back in 77, the Orange Bowl. I beat him by one, and I think he beat me by one at Innisbrook. So we kind of were laughing about that. So there were some guys that I remember. Even going back through college, we had quite a few guys on our college team that played the tour at one point or another. They didn't last near as long as I did, but over the years we had a lot of guys that played the tour.
So after high school, obviously you wind up at the University of Florida. How long did you play collegiate golf there, and at what point were you successful enough for you to say, okay, it's time to take the next step. I'm not going to do the 4 years here. It's time for me to see, where my game stacks up against the best in the world.
Yeah, I lasted 2.5 years. And I kind of knew midway through my second year that, and I was on the 5-year plan anyway, that I didn't see myself going, graduating. And I kind of planned on making it through at least 3 years. I won a tournament, a college tournament, in my sophomore year. I was actually SEC Freshman of the Year my freshman year. So I was playing a lot of good golf, playing all, I was on the starting team at Florida. We had a really good team. We won a decent amount of tournaments, which was nice. And anyway, what happened was we had a 6-round qualifier in the fall for the last two tournaments in the fall, which were big tournaments. And I think I won the 6-round qualifier by like 18 shots. It was ridiculous. I was shooting like 63 or 4 every round. And the coach didn't take me to the last two tournaments because he said I needed to stay in town and go to class and catch up on my grades, because I was kind of hanging around the C average. And he wanted me to kind of catch up on my grades. And I said, Coach, I don't really go to class whether I'm in town or out of town. I'm your best player, so you might as well take me. And he said, Calc, I don't like your attitude. So I said, whatever. And talked about it with my parents over Christmas, and just called them up and said, I entered the J.C. Goosey Mini Tour event January 3rd and 4th. I'm not coming back. So that was it. And turned pro right there that winter. Played mini tours for on and off for 4 or 5 years, but back in July of 1981, it was the last year they had two tour schools. They used to have one in the winter and one in the summer. And I got through the one in the summer right there, and ended up getting on the PGA Tour in the summer of 81.
Yeah, the other question I have for you on that is, coming out of college, was your game pretty much the same as it is now? Meaning, I know primarily the shot you see is a little cut shot. And I know a lot of good players at some point in time learn to play a draw first and then kind of go to that shot second. Was your game coming out of college pretty similar to how you played during your career? Or did you kind of have to take it to the next level and, find some areas we need to improve on and kind of eliminate one side of the golf course made sense? Or have you been playing like that for a long time before you turned pro?
That's a great question. Back, in that era, in the 70s and 80s, everybody hit a hook or a draw. I mean, that's just, nobody played a fade back then. With wooden drivers and the technology back then, to hit it anywhere, you had to hit a hook. I was kind of on again, off again tour. The year that I didn't, three of the 5 years from 81 to 86, I finished between 125 and 150, so I had conditional status. And those 3 years, I missed a tour school. And the other 2 years, I didn't make it. I made it through tour school. So those 5 years, I always had some sort of status on the tour. But anyway, in 1984 is when I started working with Peter Costas, and that's when we switched my game around from hitting a big hook to hitting up the fade, the power fade. And then it took me about a year to kind of get the hang of it. And I really started playing some good golf. And actually, it was the end of 84 I started working with them, and I started playing some really good golf. And the start of 1986, and that's kind of really when I started playing great.
And I'm assuming the idea was just to simply be more consistent week in to week out versus trying to time, you know, with those old blot of balls and that equipment. Like, you know, I'm 44 years old, so I still remember using that stuff.
Yeah.
It took nothing to turn it into a snap hook really quick.
Exactly.
So I'm assuming you took a little off the from the distance standpoint, but it was worth it from a consistency standpoint is what you were looking for.
Exactly. As you said earlier, I tried to eliminate the left half of the golf course. And as you said, the ball used to curve so much more left to right or right to left than it does now. You know, when you got a hook going or a slice going, it kept going back then. And so basically, you know, I had plenty of distance. So we you know, took a little distance off. And basically, I got a driver with 7 degrees loft and an extra stiff shaft. So basically, we got a driver that was nearly impossible to hook, number one. And number two, the only way to keep it in the air was to kind of hang back and try to hit a high fade. If I tried to hit a hook with it, it would just dive into the ground. So basically, my driver setup was such that I couldn't hook it. And if I had to hit a hook off a tee, I'd hit my 3-wood. I mean, I could hook it, but if I had to hit a hook, again, I hit my 3-wood. So, and, you know, that was kind of the start of it. And then I could just aim down the left edge of the fairway or left center of the fairway and just and go ahead and swing as hard as I wanted and just hit a nice little power fade every time with my driver. And that's really when I started to play a heck of a lot better because I was hitting a lot more fairways and just driving a lot better.
So your game gets better through Q school, out of Q school, and in 1986, you win your first event, the Southwest Golf Classic.
Yep.
As a professional golfer, what's that moment like, and what does it do for your career and your confidence? Because now you're not going back and forth. There has to be a certain level of respect on the tour that you're now a PGA Tour winner. What did that do for your career and kind of setting you up to take it to the next level?
Actually, 1986 was the first year that I started the year with absolutely zero status on the tour. And I went through a few. I missed the tour school in 85. I actually blew my knee out playing catch football on the beach at Pensacola in the last tournament of the year and had knee surgery, and I couldn't really recover in time for the finals of tour school. I tried to play, but, it was awful. So, at any rate, I Monday qualified for a few tournaments. I got a few exemptions. I qualified for the U.S. Open. I shot 65 the last round at Shinnecock Hills, which at that time got me in the Masters in 86. And I wasn't even on tour, which was kind of cool. And then Ted May gave me an exemption in Hartford, had a top 10, which got me in Boston, had another top 10, which got me in Milwaukee, had another top 10, which got me in Bank of Boston or Southwest Classic, which I won. So it was just a chain reaction of confidence that just set in. I was playing great. I felt like I really belonged out there for the first time in 6 years. And then when I won, I knew, I had a 2-year exemption. I just knew that, I belonged out there. And then I won the Honda at the start of 87. And, 5 months later in September, I was sitting in Jack Nicklaus's kitchen at Muirfield Village on the Ryder Cup team. So, basically in a year, I went from having no status on the tour to being on the Ryder Cup team in 12 months, which, a lot of people don't know. So it was pretty amazing how fast my success really came about.
And that kind of, once again, gets to my next topic I kind of have for our listeners here. Obviously, you win in 87, and then you get to the 1988 Masters, which, I had to go back and kind of do some research on it. By the way, it was one heck of a golf tournament on Sunday in that back nine. It's absolutely incredible to watch.
It was exciting.
It was exciting. I know, I'm sure you wanted to win it, but from a viewing standpoint, I forgot how good that tournament actually was. And my question is, as you're ascending, up the ranks of the PGA Tour, when you look back at the 88 Masters, and you played well that day from watching the coverage,
yeah.
When you go through something like that, are you disappointed Or do you just tip your hat to Sandy Lyle and say, hey, look, if you can make a birdie out of a bunker on 18 to win the Masters, that's just the way it goes sometimes. But you were there on that back nine on Sunday, you know, kind of taking it to the next level. So how did you view that week, kind of going through it of being super close but not quite getting over the hump per se?
Yeah, it was, it was a little disappointing, only for a little, just an hour or so right afterwards. I had just gotten into the Butler cabin, and they told me that he hit it in the fairway bunker on 18, fairly close to the lip. And I thought, okay, get ready for a playoff, because I figured, as good as Sandy Lyle was at that time, I figured that, and nobody in the world hit it higher than he did, so I wasn't worried about the lip, and I hadn't seen his lie at that point. I figured he'd get it over the lip and get it on the green and make a par. And then I got in there and I saw where his lie was, and I thought, oh, that's no problem for him. But I really wasn't thinking he was going to make birdie. And then as soon as he hit the shot, I knew he hit a great shot. And I said, oh, no, he hit a great shot. And it got up the top of the ridge and rolled back down towards the hole. And I just told everybody in there, I said, he's going to make this. I mean, he's not going to miss that. Watch this. And he poured it right in the middle and went into the press room. And, I was disappointed for a while. But then we had a great party that night, and I just kind of thought, I said, sure it would have been great to win, but I was 28 and I just started playing great and my confidence was high, and I thought, shoot, I'll win this tournament someday. It's not a big deal. I'll win it next year, or I'll win it the year after that. And I thought, I'll have another 20 tries to win this tournament. So that was kind of my thinking, that it sure would have been nice to have won, but I was so sure that I'd win it again someday. So I kind of just blew it off at that.
Did Augusta set up well for you at that time, being that the fact you did hit a slight cut with the driver? Did it visually fit your eye, or is this something you kind of had to work around a little bit? Or did you hit more three woods off tees when need be, when you have to draw it on that golf course from a right-handed player's perspective?
It actually kind of set up horrible for me, really. There were four or five holes off the tee there that were tough for me. But I just kind of tried to hit it straight. I mean, you don't have to hook it, but it helps. Probably 10 being the biggest help to hit a hook so you can catch the side of the hill and roll it down to the bottom. If you kind of hit one straight there and miss that hill, you're going to lose about 50 yards. But, some of the other holes, if you just hit it straight, you're okay. But, like I said, I always kind of had a strong three wood, and I could always hook my three wood. So I was even okay. I mean, I kind of remember over the years on 10, I kind of always tried to hook my three wood, and even 13, as time went on, I always tried to hit a three wood and hit a little bit of a hook around that corner as well. And like 14, I always kind of just tried to hit a high driver there. In case I pulled it, I could try to hit it over that tree that kind of sticks out a little bit. So, but yeah, it didn't set up great for me, but I just love the tournament so much and playing in it that, I just kind of overlooked some of the holes that didn't set up great for me.
And then, the next time you're kind of right there is in 2001 at the Masters. How much fun was that when you look at the people who were in contention at that tournament? You had, yourself, Tiger, Phil, Duval, DeMarco was right there. That had to be electric, especially, I think you birdied the first hole.
I did,
on Sunday on that.
Got right there. I felt great. And then I just kind of panicked a little bit, I think. I really felt like maybe, at 41 years old, maybe this was my shot. And might have got a little bit ahead of myself. But still, I think I hung in there tied for fourth or something. But, yeah, it was it was fun. I really kind of thought maybe that was it, especially after I birdied the first hole. I thought, here we go. And maybe started thinking a little bit ahead of myself. But, which is the last thing you need to do there, because there's, so much can happen out there. That's the last thing you need to do is start thinking ahead.
Well, let's talk about the one that you did win, the 1989 Open Championship at Royal Troon. Assuming you were playing really well going into that week, kind of how was your form going in? I'm assuming it was good. Did the course set up great for you? What were your thoughts on it? And, you know, looking back, you have to be beyond proud and of that accomplishment as the highlight of your career, I'm assuming.
Definitely the highlight of my career. I'd say my confidence was definitely at an all-time high with, you know, nearly winning the Masters. Later on that year, I won the Bank of Boston Classic, then went over to Australia, won the Australian Open in 88. You know, and then in 89, I won Phoenix, won L.A. So, you know, it was a good stretch, winning four tournaments, you know, in a 4-month period or 5-month period. And had some other good tournaments and got to Troon. And my first practice round, I played with Curtis Strange and I played Mark O'Meara and I played Curtis Strange and Arnold Palmer. And so my first look at Royal Troon was with Arnold Palmer. And, you know, it was just, the weather was beautiful all week. It was 70 degrees with about a 10-mile-an-hour breeze. They were in a drought. It was really dry, but it was just a great week of weather. I love the golf course. At first look, every hole looked great to me. And I was playing great. And we birdied the last hole to take 50 pounds off of Arnie and had Arnie sign the $50 bill for me. So that was something I'll never forget. So it was start to a great week. So that was probably an omen right there.
And then obviously going down, you know, the final nine on that, you're up against Greg Norman. I mean, so he's playing great at that time. That pressure had to be crazy, yet you performed. I mean, once again, I looked back at some of those highlights from that, and you hit some great golf shots coming down the stretch. And then the other story from doing some research for this, was you did not know about the four-hole playoff once you actually got to that point. So how did that kind of change your mindset, or did it kind of loosen you up a little bit knowing you had four holes, or how did you feel coming down the stretch? And then with winning it in that four-hole playoff, was that sort of a good omen that you weren't going to do it from sudden death, that you kind of had four holes to play with?
Yeah, that was a good thing. I mean, on Sunday, it was, you know, Wayne Grady was kind of winning the thing the whole week. And I was, you know, at least four or five back pretty much all day. And Greg was birdied the first six holes on Sunday. So it was, you know, I really wasn't thinking about winning at all. I was just trying to have a really good finish. And, you know, all of a sudden I flew that chip on the hole on number 12. And, you know, and then I just didn't miss a shot after that. I birdied 16, and then Greg was done at 13 under. And I knew on 18, if I had any chance, I needed to birdie 18 and, hit that 8-iron in there from just short of that bunker that Greg, ended up hitting it into in the playoff. I hit it in close, and then, got a little help from Wayne Grady when he bogeyed, 14 and 17. And then, as you said, when we were getting ready for the playoff, I had no idea. I said, I assume we're going to 18. He says, no, we're going to one. I said, one? That's kind of a strange hole for a sudden death playoff. He says, no, we're playing 1, 2, 17, and 18. I said, oh, thank God. That just immediately kind of relaxed me a little bit. I was still obviously kind of nervous, but I was kind of really relieved to know that we were playing four holes because, you know, one hole, anything can happen. So that was nice. And, you know, Greg birdied the first hole again. So, had a little extra time to make it up, and as it turned out, it worked out pretty good for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great victory, and it seems over the years, the Open Championship has even gotten bigger in the sense of respect that people have for the people who've won that championship. I personally think it's the greatest championship in the world. Is that a fair statement? You think it's gotten even bigger since you've kind of won it?
No, I totally think so. All the majors have, really, but especially the Open. You know, when I go there now, I've got three left I can play in until I turn 60, which is now the age where they kind of cut you off, you know, which is fine. I'm not sure I'd really want to go over there and play, you know, older than that. I think it's really a pretty good goal for me to go over there and not only make the cut, but, you know, if I could finish in the top 20 or 30, I think it'd be a pretty good effort. But, yeah, I mean, the tournament, the atmosphere the Open Championship is just is so cool. You know, the crowds are awesome. I mean, they've always been awesome, but just the event itself is just so huge. It's just, there's really nothing like it.
And like I said, I can't imagine what that moment must be like when they hand you the claret jug. It's got to be, you know, all of that work for all those years and all that time kind of coming together in that one moment. I imagine it takes some time for it to even, you know, set in with, my God, what have you accomplished? It's got to be the greatest feeling in the world to be called the champion golfer of the year and handed that essentially a piece of history.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When I was holding that thing, making that speech, it was you're so kind of overwhelmed with what just happens. You know, I don't even remember what I said, quite honestly. You just kind of blab something out of there and hope it sounds okay. But, you know, and then you do the press and whatnot and have a glass of champagne with all the volunteers and it kind of goes by. It's, and then I was, my buddy was caddying for me for about 10 years, and we're riding back to the hotel in the courtesy car. And like you just said, we're riding back and I'm holding the jug there and I'm looking at the claret jug. And like you just said, I was like, oh my God, what the hell just happened? And it just, you know, it was just amazing. It really was.
And then in 2012, you're right there again for your second one. Can you talk about that week? I know you end up finished tied for seventh, but once again, how much fun was it to be, you know, in your 50s at that point competing for a major, and how close were you? And that seems like a major that guys, I mean, obviously you've competed in it well. Tom Watson almost won it at 59 on the right venue with the right conditions. I think guys in the, unless I'm wrong, guys in their 50s are going to be able to compete on that event for, will be able to compete for that event for a while, I think, you know, unless they make the changes to the courses where it gets crazy long. But
right.
What's your thoughts on the 2012 and how close were you on that one?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, Norman had a good chance to win at Brookdale when he was, I think, 57 or 8. So, yeah, I played great that week. And I was coming down the stretch of the last four or five holes. And, you know, I knew I was four or five back, but I thought, and I'd laid up all week on 16, and they moved the tee up a little bit. And I thought, well, shoot, who knows, if I hit a perfect drive and blow it on the green on 16 and make a two or at least a three, and then maybe birdie one of the last two, you never know. And of course I hit it in a bush or something on 16. I made a five and parred the last two. But, you know, if I would have birdied 16 instead of bogeyed it, I would have got myself in the Masters again. So, you know, I was that close to having a shot at it again. So it was, but you're right. Of any tournament for a senior player to have a chance, especially in a major, I think that's it.
Yeah, it makes sense, especially it's fast firm conditions, and you guys have experience where that really has a factor of how you handle those, you know, the course conditions, and it's not your first rodeo and you've seen the courses before.
Right.
Speaking of which, what are, obviously, Troon's your favorite golf course, I would assume, in the rotation, which would make sense.
Yep.
What's your other top three or four, you know, courses you enjoy playing most in the rotation, or in the roto, I should say?
Even though we haven't played there since 2012, Lytham's my second favorite. I just really like the way that course looks to me. And, you know, a lot of it over there with a lot of guys is the way they appeal to your eye. And I like Brookdale. I didn't go last year because my ball just has like a magnetic attraction to the bunkers over there. And I see the bunkers, you know, and it's weird. I just kind of see my ball going on these bunkers, and it's weird. And I like the course. I like the area. I like everything about it. I like the town. And of course, I love the tournament. It was hard not to go, but the course just frustrates the crap out of me. But I love Lytham. Carnoustie this year is one of my favorites, even though it can be a beast. You know, if the weather's a little shaky over there, you can be out there all day. But it's one of my favorites. You know, I like them all. I'm also looking forward to the Senior Open at St. Andrews this year. That'll be a real treat as well. So it'll be a fun 2 weeks over there.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's my favorite tournament in the world to watch, and it's the courses, the history, all of it's absolutely spectacular. Next question I have for you, kind of going back to 2001 at the Phoenix Open, PGA Tour scoring record, 28 under par. Same kind of question. What happened before that week, and did you see that coming, and what is it like to play at that level of the hole must look like a basketball hoop, and you must be so dialed in? How much fun was that week, and what's sort of your memories of that, and, you know, what does it take to keep the pedal down, to keep going lower and lower and lower in that position when you're out in front and you're obviously playing great? It's got to be a ton of fun to be in that position.
You know, it was weird, and I remember about that week. I was on the range on Tuesday on the very left hand of the range, which is kind of over there by the 10th green, and I was working on something, and all of a sudden something clicked, and I hit literally like 20 iron shots in a row that landed within a foot of each other in a row. And I told my caddy, I said, I didn't see anybody on 10 green. I said, let's run over and play like 11 through 16 or whatever. Let's run over 11. And I birdied like 11, 13, 14, 15, and 16. And I said, okay, I think I'm onto something. And I went out the next day in the Pro-Am and shot 64 pretty much without even trying. Same sort of thing. It was effortless. I found it. And then, you know, in the tournament, same thing. I just kept hitting every shot straight at the flag. And, you know, it was just, you know, and then a week later, I lost it. So, weird thing. I was in my garage and, I looked at my putter that I used to win that tournament. I looked at it and I looked at it and I said, oh yes, I made a lot of putts with this thing. So I had a good memory looking at it. So,
and wasn't there also a new driver in the bag that week with the Bimatrix shaft? If I'm going off memory here.
Yep. Bimatrix, again, just had the power fade working nice. I drove it fantastic, long and straight. And, you know, the weather wasn't really very good that week either. I think I had Rocco Mediate by 8, and Steve Lowry was seven more behind him. So I had, like, third place covered by, like, 15 shots. I mean, that's kind of, like, Tiger-esque. You know, those kind of numbers. So to shoot those kind of numbers in bad weather was just a unbelievable golf.
Well, I was a True Temper distributor at that time, so I would like to thank you for the amount of Bimatrix shafts we sold after that tournament was over. Everyone had to get one after that performance.
Yeah, it was a good Bimatrix time.
Exactly. Next question I have is on the Ryder Cup. And just looking back at that, some of your best memories, you know, what did it mean for your career? And also making it, you know, at 42 years old from your first team to your last team, there was quite a bit of a gap. And to get on there again at that age, was it even more special, you know, as you got a little later in your career to make the Ryder Cup team again?
Yeah, that was cool. I wanted to get on another team. You know, my 87, my first team was kind of, like I said, it happened so fast, and we kind of got boat raced. They just made everything on the greens. Jack's theory was near Field Village that was, he was going to get the greens so fast that it was just going to freak him out. And it kind of went the opposite way. I think they just looked like pool tables to him. And Jose and Seve and the boys, they just made everything they looked at that week. So that, you know, that, as it turned out, wasn't a whole lot of fun. And then the next year, in 89, we kind of, me and I think Mark McCumber and, I don't know, there were four of us hit it in the water in 18, and we somehow managed to tie that one 14-14. So that was a catastrophe. So we were all bummed out because we didn't, you know, because they won the cup in 87. We didn't, because we tied, they kept it. So that wasn't that much fun. And then finally in 91, we won the thing, but, you know, I collapsed against Monty. So that wasn't that much fun. But I will say, no, I shouldn't say it wasn't much fun. It was actually a great week. You know, that was kind of the start of the whole thing, really, with the crowds and you know, everybody getting so fired up about the Ryder Cup. And then finally, I got remarried in 05 and met my my wife in 01. So it was cool for her to, my second wife in 01. So it was cool for her to go to the Ryder Cup and see what it was all about in 02. So that was a lot of fun, even though we lost.
And then looking at the 91 Ryder Cup, which, you know, the struggles you had in the back nine, which has been chronicled. But the question I have more from that is, you know, you bounced back pretty quick. Like, you won in 1992, early in the year, I believe, at Phoenix. So,
yep.
You know, as a golfer, we all go through tough patches where you're not playing up to the level that you expect. How did you get through that? And then how did you turn that negative, I'm assuming, into a positive and come back out? And the next time you're in contention, you know, you got the job done and you won.
Actually, I bounced back the next week. I think I finished fifth in Texas the next week. You know what? The fans were great to me. I must have got 500 letters in my locker from fans and in San Antonio, and every one of them, not one letter was negative or mean letter. Every single one of them said, "You're one of the reasons we won that Ryder Cup, because you got off to such a great start. You won 2.5 points. You and Payne were great, and, you know, this and that." So, you know, everything was great. I got off to such a fast start against Monty, and, you know, it fired everybody up and this and that. So, you know, everybody was great, and that certainly helped me a lot. You know, and I was bummed out right afterwards. There's no question. I think anybody would have been. And I just kind of knew it was going to come down to the last match. And, Bernhard hit a good putt. It just broke a ton. I don't think anybody really could have read that putt to break that much. But, you know, I don't even, you know, some of those pictures when we're out in the ocean in our blue jackets taking pictures and stuff, I honestly don't even remember that. It was kind of weird. But anyway, you know, the next week I played some pretty good golf and got over it quick. And, you know, today, me and Colin Montgomery are good friends. He's playing the Champions Tour, and he loves it. And, you know, all's good. So it was, you know, if anything, I took it way too hard. But, you know, at the time, you know, it's emotional. It's an emotional event.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the one, like you said, that kind of, I think, put the Ryder Cup on the next level of intensity and,
I think so, yeah.
On both sides, and so it was kind of the start of the modern Ryder Cup. And but yeah, it's interesting to see how you bounce back, because like I said, we as golfers, we all kind of struggle with, you know, not playing the level you want to sometimes, but you learn from it and move on. Working with Butch Harmon, I know you did that for years. What's the best attributes of Butch, and what did you get out of that relationship, and why is he such a great teacher?
Yeah, Butch is awesome. You know, actually all the Harmon brothers are. I've worked a little with Craig as well. But the 10 years I worked with Butch, he just makes practicing fun, which is probably his greatest attribute. He's not, you know, you just don't stand there and pound ball after ball after ball and where it just gets monotonous. You'll hit four or five shots and you'll stand there and you'll yuck it up and laugh for a couple minutes. Or you'll hit four or five balls and he'll go, "Okay, let's look at this." And you'll look at the, you know, computer, you'll look at the screen and talk about your swing. And then, you know, talk about, you know, the game on the other night or whatever. Or, you know, we'll go into his office and, you know, we'll practice for an hour and then go sit down for 20 minutes. And, you know, it's just, he makes the day enjoyable. You know, his eye is incredible. He's just a good guy. You know, all the players that have worked with him, he doesn't try to drastically change any part of your swing. You know, Ricky Fowler's swing doesn't look much different than it always did. Phil's swing doesn't look much different than it always did. It's just little things that he picks up on that make a huge difference. And, you know, I think that's the genius of Butch Harmon.
And another one of his former students, Tiger Woods. I know over the years you got to be good friends with Tiger. And from what I read, he basically loved giving you the needle, right? I mean, that was – he loved to essentially just give you shit, if I'm not correct on that, right? And
oh, yeah.
it looks like now he's sort of coming out of, you know, being in character of the assassin on the golf course all the time. But I'm assuming just for how light he is now with the younger players – when you're friends with Tiger, he's probably more like that than what we see from the public sees of him on the golf course.
Yeah, there's no question. We used to play, you know, a lot of times when I was, when, you know, when Butch used to be in Houston at Lock and Bar, you know, I'd go there, Tiger would be there, or, you know, when I went to Vegas when Butch is, well, he's still there at Rio Seco, Tiger would be there, vice versa, or wherever, or at majors or certain other golf tournaments. You know, we'd play practice rounds together. We always played practice rounds together at majors and whatnot. So we always had a lot to talk about, and Tiger was always very personable and would certainly rib me or, you know, make fun of how fat I was or whatever, you know. But he's always funny about it, and you know, it's you can kind of give him grief right back, and he laughs and takes it in a funny way. You know, having said that, you know, the last 9 years have been a little different for him, obviously, you know, once things started going the wrong way for him. And, you know, it's been like that with him, with even with his best friends, John Cook and Marco Mira. You know, they don't talk to him near as much as they used to. And, but, you know, I think Tiger kind of had to go that way. So it's a little unfortunate. I mean, he lives 4 miles from me now, and I never see him or talk to him. So it's a little bit unfortunate.
From what you've seen in his golf swing, do you think he looks pretty promising for 2018? For the little that you've probably seen on TV or
yeah,
was kind of working on or doing?
I thought he looked great last month in the Hero World Challenge. I really did. He certainly wasn't holding back any. I mean that shows me he's got zero thoughts or zero issues with his back. So, I mean, you can tell, especially with his follow through and his through swing. I mean, he's straightening up a lot faster than he used to, which is the follow through to protect the bad back. You know, he's not staying out over the ball near as long as he used to, which is again protecting a bad back. But his backswing looks great, and his impact position looks great. You know, he just after he hits the ball, he just stands up a little faster than he used to, which is, you know, okay. The only issue there is if he does that a little bit fast, he's going to hit it right. And if I'm not mistaken, I watched maybe a couple days of it, but the misses that I saw were usually to the right. And, you know, if you stand up on it a little fast or come out of it a little quick, you're going to hit it right. And I think that was his only issue. So I thought he looked fantastic. I really did.
I think it'll be great for golf if he can come back and be competitive with these young kids.
Every player wants him to come back. I mean, the whole golf world wants him to come back. I mean, and the game's been great without him. I mean, that's been the great thing. The game's in great shape without him, but it's going to be even in better shape with him. So it's going to be awesome. And I hope he stays healthy and plays up until he's who knows how old.
Well, this kind of goes into my next question once again is you played really well. Tiger's in his 40s, and this is the context of the question, but in 2005 through 2007, you were in your mid to late 40s, and you played fantastic on the PGA Tour. My question is, what motivated you at that point after everything you accomplished to keep playing at that level, and how much fun was it to do it, you know, at the point where a lot of guys are starting to fall off, where you're still very, very competitive and winning on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I think, you know, at that time, I was still feeling great, and, you know, I think my swing, you know, with you know, over the years with Peter Costas' help and Butch Harmon's help, my swing's not that complicated, you know, and it never really goes that far off kilter. So I've always been, and when it does, you know, I've got 4 or 5 or 6 things that I kind of think about or work on, and, you know, I can usually kind of fix myself if I'm a little bit off. So, you know, plus I like to buy things. I like to spend money. So, you know, I'm motivated to keep playing and keep earning money playing golf. And I love to, you know, and I was fortunate, you know, winning at 45 and 47 and, you know, it's not that easy to do. So it was definitely a blessing. And, you know, like I said, I was exempt right up until I got to the Champions Tour and, you know, that's a hard thing to do.
Well, the other questions I have coming up for you here are a little bit more on the lighter side. So I have heard the story about the pro-am where the, and if I'm not telling it exactly right, let me know, where essentially your clubs, your clothes, everything was lost, and or a corporate outing event, and then you had to play with golf shoes that didn't fit, et cetera, and then if I recall the story, you go like 10 under par and then buy the putter off the kid who clubs you borrowed or something to that extent. How does this story go?
Yeah, you pretty much got the nail on the head. I flew into Newark. I had an outing at Somerset Hills, which is a great golf course. And I had about, I don't know, three stops. I was flying from Phoenix. Didn't get there till about 3 a.m. Of course, no luggage, no nothing, no clubs, pretty much no sleep. Got to the hotel at 4:30 a.m, a couple hours of sleep, and I get up and still nothing. So I knock on Peter Jacobson's door, borrow a shirt. Still got the underwear and my socks on from my jeans. And thought Carl Paulson, Carl Peterson was my same size. So I asked him what size waist he was, and he said 36. And I'm like, oh, bullshit, you're not 36. But I thought he's more like a 40. So I forget whose pants I borrowed. But anyway, found some clothes, get to the course, used a regular shafted TaylorMade like driver that was really whippy, kind of hit it all over the map. Ping Eye irons. My caddy's putter, which was an answer, which I was kind of familiar with. Anyway, 18 holes later, 10 under par, 62 I fired, which is a new course record. No L wedge, just a regular sand wedge. Hit it on the green, made putts from all over the map, and talked the kid into selling me his putter.
How long did the putter last before that one week?
Yeah, one week. Missed everything. Yeah, that was it. Never made another putt with it.
And the stories also go, you have to punish the putters when they're bad. So did that one get thrown out of a car or let it outside in some rain for a little bit?
I'm not sure what happened to it, quite honestly. I'd like to tell you I sent it back to him, but I don't think I did.
I've been known
to punish a few putters over the years.
Is there any great stories from that you can share of one good one where the putter wasn't listening to you and you had to show it who's boss?
Yeah, Kapalua one year, after about four straight rounds of about 36 putts, I hung it out the car door window and dragged it all the way back to the Ritz-Carlton. And I actually kind of hurt my wrist because I hit a few little reflectors in the highway. You know, it's about a 2 or 3 mile drive back to the hotel. And ground it down on the road, hanging it out the car door, and pulled over to this sort of the hotel to this, found this brick wall and started throwing it up against this wall. And then this bus full of tourists drove by and saw this madman throwing this putter up against this brick wall. And everybody just kind of looked at me like I'd lost my mind, which I had. I just snapped. So all I got out of that was a really sore, inflamed wrist. But, the putter didn't make it.
And you got a good story out of it.
Yeah, I got a good story out of it.
The other sport I've heard you're quite passionate about is bowling. My question is, how good were you at the top of your bowling game? And then do you have more holes in ones or 300 games from your bowling?
I've got a lot more hole in ones because I believe it or not, have no 300 games. I've got probably more stretches of strikes than hole-in-ones. I've got 18 hole-in-ones, but, I've got who knows how many times I've thrown 15 or 16 strikes in a row, but just like the last 8-1 game and the first 6 or 7 of another game, but somehow not all 12 in one game. 289 is my high. I got robbed. I had 10 in a row and threw a beautiful shot in the 11th and a solid 10-10 and picked it up for 289. But, I went bowling last month and wasn't too bad. My last house that we just sold a few years ago, I had a 2-lane bowling alley in there and we had a lot of fun with that. And I threw like back-to-back 279 games in there, which was nice. But at my peak, I probably was averaging around 210 to 215 for quite a while. You know, a lot depends on the lanes, how they're oiled. You know, sometimes they're too oily, sometimes they're too dry, and sometimes they're just right. So, on occasion, lanes can be really tough to shoot good scores on.
But we could pretty much say you were a scratch golfer in bowling, essentially. You got pretty darn good at it.
I'm a pretty good bowler. And our boy Dustin Johnson, who's pretty good at everything, he came over to the house and bowled quite a bit. And he's pretty handy with a bowling ball in his hands, too. No shock there. He's probably pretty good at pretty much everything he does.
I was going to say, I can imagine him being like world-class and throwing a javelin or something. There's no sport that looks like
right.
That guy can't play. Another question I have, best two or three golf courses in the world that you've played, and what makes them so great?
Well, my favorite golf course in the United States is Sand Hills in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, which I think was Ben Crenshaw and Bill Kors first course that they might have done. I thought every hole was fantastic. I just absolutely loved it. I'm from Nebraska originally, but that's not the reason. I just thought it was just awesome. Everybody that I've talked to that's been there to play it just says the same thing. They just love it. Shinnecock Hills is right up there. Everything about it's fantastic. The holes are great. It's beautiful. Love it. Of course, Royal Trin's right up there. With it, as far as beauty goes, Pebble Beach and Cypress Point are right up there. You get down to Australia. I'm not going to say Royal Melbourne because it's a composite course, but Kingston Heath is my favorite down there. There's a lot of them on the list I want to play, but so many good ones out there.
I'm assuming you've played Pine Valley.
I have played Pine Valley. You know what? I loved it. I thought it was gorgeous. I was surprised the fairways were as wide as they were and the greens were as big as they were, but I still loved it. The day I played, I just kept hitting fairways and greens and two putting. So it was I made 16 pars, a birdie and a bogey. I couldn't make a putt or get an iron shot within 30 feet. So it was kind of a nondescript day, but, thought it was really, really cool. Beautiful.
You have three guys you can pick from the Champions Tour or the PGA Tour to go out and play a fun round of golf with, play a little money game, have dinner and drinks afterwards. Which three guys are you grabbing?
Three from each tour?
Nope, either tour. Since all your years I'm playing the regular tour, some of the younger guys still could be out there now, or guys from the Champions Tour. The three guys would just be the most fun from either tour for that sort of a day of fun.
Well, you got to throw Phil Mickelson in there. We used to have some all-time great gambling games, and I was always in that group, you know, where we went out and played, and nobody talks more smack than him, more garbage than him, and most of it's pretty funny, and he'll play you for whatever you want to play for. So Phil, he's probably my favorite guy to watch, because you never know what the heck's going to happen with him. So he's up there. Who else do we have? Paul Azinger was one of my buddies. He's also right up there, all-time funniest guy. And John Houston is a name from the past.
John Houston, what attribute of great ball striker, what attribute would make him so much fun to bring along with this group with the golf, the dinner, the drinks? What makes, because he seems kind of like as a dry personality.
He's right, just a super dry sense of humor. And really witty, really smart. Come up with a super funny one-liner out of nowhere. And not afraid of anybody. We'll play it for whatever you want. Was always a good partner. He was my partner in a President's Cup match. We were 9-under at Royal Melbourne in the 1998 President's Cup. And we lost to Shigeki Maruyama and Joe Ozaki 3-2. And we were 9-under. And he looks at me. And he goes, "You want to tell these blanking two idiots they're not that good, or you want me to?" He was getting so mad. They were making putts everywhere, and I mean, he was about to lose it. So, I mean, it was pretty funny. But yeah, we got They were 9 under and got dusted off 3-2. That doesn't happen too often.
Best golf shot you've ever hit under pressure?
Ooh. Well, got to be one of the two shots on 18 at Trim. Might be the first one because I had to have it. The 8-iron on the 72nd hole of regulation from 163 that I hit in there 3 feet left of the hole. The 5-iron's a close second, but, you know, Greg was in the lip, you know, in that bunker that is absolutely dead. So, you know, I just kind of knew I had to get it on the green and I was in going to be in good shape. But, you know, the fact that I hit it 7 feet is another story, but probably the 8-iron because I actually got nervous on it. You know, I was fine, and I stood over it and caught this wave of, like, nervous nausea, and I backed off of it, and I rarely back off of a shot unless the wind, I catch a big gust or something. But I backed off of it because I got extra nervous all of a sudden out of nowhere. And I took a deep breath, and I said, okay, just, you know, do your thing here. And I got up there and just flushed it right at the hole. So probably that one.
Best golf shot you've ever witnessed under pressure that was not you, that you were playing with or saw, that you were just blown away with the quality of the shot under the circumstances?
That I saw in person?
Yes. And I think I might know the answer to my next question here. If you need some time on that one, who's the most talented?
Yeah, let me think about that for a second.
No worries. Who's the most talented player you've ever been around? Just from raw talent.
Raw talent? Yeah, it'd be hard not to say Tiger.
I would have to. I mean, yeah, in his prime, there had to be golf shots that even other touring pros were just mesmerized by how good it was.
Yeah, I mean, just some of the shots that he hit that come to mind, he just made it look almost impossible, you know. I mean, just some of the putts that he made and some of the shots that he hit, especially under all kinds of pressure. You know, the fairway bunker shot in Canada, you know, it comes to mind on 18. You know, stuff like that, just nobody can do.
Yeah, the infamous 6-iron at
Open
to that par 5. Yeah, that, I mean, that was incredible from 200 yards to be able to do that.
Or even the little, you know, whatever shot comes to mind is the little 94-yard wedge shot he hit at Pebble Beach on 15 when he won the AT&T. That back right pin, it landed at like 2 feet right of the hole and just dribbled to the left and trickled in the hole. I mean, I've played that hole 100 times, and I don't know if I've ever got close to that pin. And to hit a pitching wedge that easy and take all the spin off it, because the greens are so soft and the ball spins so much to do that. You know, hit that little dead arm wedge shot that he hits is just that was an amazing shot.
I've got two more quick questions that are just kind of off the top of the head type of answers to it. The last time you've had to pay for a round of golf outside of not your country club membership, but you just go in to play golf, I'm assuming you don't have to pay very often. But is there a time where you've actually had to pay?
Yeah, there is. Wasn't that long ago either.
Really? They don't give you the hall pass of 13 PGA Tour wins and say, go ahead, Mr. Kalkovecchia?
Let me think. Where was it? I know for a fact, although this was about 15 years ago, I had to pay at the PGA National. I had to pay there to play. They don't care who you are. You got to pay there.
They didn't even just charge you for the cart fee. You had to pay the green fee on top of it.
Yeah. I think I got some sort of slight discount, but yeah, give you the PGA rate or something, $75. I'm like, okay, whatever.
Have you ever been to a Top Golf facility?
Yeah, I loved it. Thought of the blast. Been to the one in Scottsdale a couple times.
Do you get recognized when you're there?
Yeah.
Because I would have to imagine the numbers that you got to be pretty good at hitting the same shot to 150-yard hole. I imagine the scores are pretty solid when you're out at Top Golf.
I was just curious
if you've ever been to it and thoughts on it.
We were at the one in Scottsdale a couple different times, and it was, you know, that one's always kind of packed. And, both times we were there, and, you know, I was there with my you know, decent amount of people, and everybody's kind of making a big deal out of it. And yeah, I was recognized and hitting these shots, and some people were watching and shit. So, but yeah, it was kind of cool. I saw Mark Leishman was, he went to wherever he was at, and he was at a Top Golf, and, you know, he put his name up on the board, and everybody's like, Mark Leishman. So I guess they, you know, he was on some sort of leaderboard or whatever, and was killing everybody, like, naturally. Yeah. But yeah, I think those places are great.
That's what he said he did for his off-season workout, essentially, with bad weather. He kept going to Top Golf.
Exactly.
He played well that week, so it worked out fine for him.
Yes.
Last question I have is I saw this from Twitter that I didn't even know this until I really thought about it, but the PNC father-son tournament, how have you not been invited to play in that? I'm more curious than anything. And then do you want us to start a movement for you on our Twitter feed to get Kelk and family into the PNC father-son tournament, kind of like the guys did for had no laying up for pray for Ted Scott. Should we start this movement to help you?
Yeah, I tried to make nice with him this year, and I sent out a super nice tweet and say, oh, you know, gee, it looks like such a great time and whatnot. But I don't know. I guess it's an IMG deal, and kind of seems weird that Fred Funk, you know, gets in and I don't. Seems how he hadn't even won a major. But yeah, it's frustrating. You know, I'd love to play. My son's out golfing right now with his grandfather out in Phoenix. He sent me a text. He said he's out playing. So he can hit it pretty good. You know, I think we'd probably finish in the middle of the pack somewhere. But, yeah, I think that was a tweet I sent out. You know, it's truly an event where the score you shoot doesn't matter. You know, it's just I think we'd have a blast. And it looks like everybody has such a good time. It's such a fun week. And, you know, I think it would be truly one of the highlights of my career, really. I think it'd be awesome.
All right, we're definitely going to start it. We will be pushing that on Twitter to get Kelk and Son into the PNC Father tournament. That's we'll definitely be on your side of that next year. So, but truly want to say thank you for your time on this. It's been an honor to have you on the podcast, and thank you for this. And
yeah, my pleasure.
I hope you play well in 2018, and appreciate everything from your time, and have a great season this year.
You got it, buddy. Anytime.
All right, guys. So that was the interview with Kelk. Hopefully you liked it. Thanks again to Mark Kalkovecchia. We had an awesome time and really enjoyed the conversation. So hopefully he'll perform really well this year on the Champions Tour, and maybe we'll be able to have him on again later in the season. Next week, we are recording two new interviews. The first will be with former PGA Tour winner, teacher, and TV analyst Bobby Clampett. The second will be with Adam Beach, who is the owner and creator of a third-party testing company called My Golf Spy. So we're looking forward to both of those conversations. We are really looking to get the podcast off the ground, and we appreciate all of the early interest in that. Please feel free to contact us through social media on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. The account name is GolfSub70. Thanks again for listening, and we will have some more episodes up soon.